When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we review the week in the Champions League as Manchester United go out in pretty dire circumstances. Juventus are blitzed by Villarreal. We'll also talk about the Premier League as Liverpool close the gap on Manchester City. But would Erling Haaland hit the ground running at the Etihad? We'll also look ahead to a big weekend in the FA Cup. This is The Game. Hiya there, welcome back to The Game. I'm Hugh Wizencroft alongside Tom Clark and Ian Hawkey. Ian on his way back from Lille. Of course, Champions League has been the order of the week thus far as we speak. It's early on Thursday morning. Chelsea cruising through with a 2-1 win against Lille, 4-1 on aggregate. Thomas Tuchel proving his worth again by switching things during the game. Got a lot of praise for his in-game tactics, shall we say, Ian. We'll talk about Chelsea in more detail in terms of their search for new owners later. Let's focus in the first part of the podcast on the actual football. And it was comfortable last night and professional, should we call it?
Yes, it was. There are uncomfortable phases. Lille were quite aggressive at the start, and they got some reward for that and obviously went ahead on the night, which could have led to a nervous moment. And Chelsea were, you know, efficient and organised about dampening that. You know, a big crowd in Lille and potential banana skin. But, you know, Tuchel's good at that in knockout ties. He's good at restoring order. And obviously, Christian Pulisic, his excellent goal just before half time, really took the wind out of Lille's sails. So, yeah, cruising through, is I think you've got that right.
Absolutely, they are. We'll also discuss whether they should actually be in the Champions League with Martin Ziegler a little bit later on. So stay tuned for that. Elsewhere in the Champions League, though, at Old Trafford, Atletico Madrid doing a number, if you like, on Manchester United. Both sides showing why they aren't on the list for favourites for the competition. Let's call it that. But Ian, it was an old school masterclass of Simeone's Atleti, if you like. S. Howe's read his best.
Absolutely. And many Atleti fans would say, and overdue for that. This has been a really non-Simeone season for most of it. You know, they've conceded goals, they've looked sloppy. He's looked like you can't reach for the solutions, which is, you know, which worries Atletico fans because some of them are young enough not to actually remember the pre-Simeone era. He's been there for so long. But yeah, this was, you know, it was all the great sort of pillars of classic Simeone Atletico. Oblak back to his best, and it's been a while since you could say that of him. I was particularly impressed with Antoine Griezmann for his discipline. A couple of years ago, Antoine Griezmann left Atletico Madrid, where, you know, he was a hero, to go to Barcelona, and I think part of the rationale was, you know, let me explore the flair side of my game. He spent a lot of the second half at Old Trafford playing at what appeared to be right back, and did so brilliantly. And, you know, but this is, you know, this is the ethos he knows, that, you know, we're going to be backs against the wall, and I'm going to be playing deep in my own half a lot of the time, and I'm going to do it very well. And I thought his diligence was quite something.
I think that was typical of the team as well. They showed that extra work rate that you need in this competition, in particular, if you're not a free-flowing, fluent side. Paul Scholes, Tom, said afterwards, the former Manchester United midfielder, of course, that had Diego Simeone been managing Manchester United in that game, they would have gone through, that Ralph Rangnick maybe in particular, maybe just his players lacked that nous in this competition.
That's partly true, isn't it, when you think that it's a team that starts with Jadon Sancho and Anthony Elanga, but they also signed Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, Mr. Champions League, probably specifically for this reason in these big games. Bruno Fernandes is an incredibly experienced quality player at the highest level. So I'm not necessarily sure that's actually true. I thought United played okay as well in patches. I've definitely seen them play a lot worse this season. I don't know about you, Hugh. I thought they were okay. And at times they played with a pace and intensity to their game that hasn't always been evident. So it kind of felt, and look, I've said this before about Manchester United, this Manchester United in big games, it felt like the reality of where they are at in terms of, you know, the overall picture. They're an okay team with a couple of star names. Sometimes they might have got the goal, you know, the Elanga chance. Yes, Oblak, great save, or did it just hit him in the face? It's a debate as to where you stand on goalkeepers and bias and things like that. And I honestly thought Manchester United were okay, one of their better performances, but, you know, just come up short. And maybe some of the players like Pogba and Rashford coming off the bench, you know, don't quite have the same impact as they would have done if they were in good form.
Okay is exactly how most people described it. You know, as a Manchester United fan, you're always disappointed to be knocked out of competition. But as exits in the Champions League go, it wasn't an 8-2 against Bayern Munich, which, as you know, was my big fear in the Champions League this year. So, you know, there was a small part of me that said we went out. People said we played okay, you know, against a perceived big club and actually aren't very good at the moment either. And I think it is just, it all pointed towards overhaul. It almost felt like a light relief. Do you remember the comments that I think Jolyon Lescott once made? And it might have been about Aston Villa being relegated. I'm sure it was Jolyon Lescott, where he basically said, now we've been relegated, we can all just have a breather. We can all just relax a little bit. And the fans were absolutely incandescent because it was like, well, hold on a minute. What is it meant to be a relief to go down? But I think he sort of meant, well, now we're actually officially down. We can all just take stock. We can have a breather. The pressure, the scrutiny is off us as individuals. And I think it felt like almost a relief. For me, this was the end of Manchester United as we know them. This was very much, this is acceptable for Manchester United. It's okay to be okay and be knocked out in the last 16. And it's not that bad. And it's not a headline story. And it's not a massive back page. They are just who they are, which is probably a Europa League team in a competition above their station. And you know what? It is what it is. I'm okay with that. It doesn't hurt as much as it probably should.
But maybe that's a personal thing for you, Hugh. But I feel like, to take your Jolyon Lescott analogy, Manchester United were relegated a good few years ago in terms of using that analogy of going from where they once were to where they are now. I felt like that happened a long time ago.
I don't think it was accepted. And now I think it is accepted.
Yeah, maybe the acceptance you're talking about is within Manchester United fans themselves. But to come back to your first question to me, I don't, you know, Ian's probably better placed to answer it. I don't know whether, and this is why we dance around the subject of Ranić, Pochettino, Brendan Rodgers at one point. Then you're going to start looking at Ancelotti. I don't know whether the Scholes point about Simeone, you know, is actually true. I don't know. Ian, do you agree? Do you think you look at that team and go, yes, that's one that Simeone could mould?
Actually, on the specifics of that, no. I think there would be, there would be an awkward fit with Simeone and current Manchester United, and not even just for the personnel. I think, as I've said at some length before, I Simeone is unusual in that he's so welded in terms of his success as a coach to one particular club, and it is a very particular club, Atletico, that he's not one of those managers I would say, oh yes, now he'd be a good fit. He'd sort X, Y, and Z out quickly and then build something. Because I'm not sure if there's the evidence that he could. You assume that he would make any team, any dressing room he entered, more competitive and more fierce. You know, I'm not sure if he's the one you would automatically reach for in the repeated search for the next perfect Manchester United manager.
When I say that we've, you know, it's that moment that everyone can have a breather, what I really mean is I think it was that point that everyone who is, whether you're involved in Manchester United anyway or not, could say, this is overhaul time. this is it. You know, all of the arguments around ownership or around coaching or around individual players being good enough or not, we can stop arguing about all of those things. And we've all come to a general feeling that everything needs to be thrown out the window. Manchester United need to start again. And there is no point having all of these arguments back and forth anymore. Let's just go back to square one. Do you understand what I mean by that?
I do, but I think maybe what you're getting at is that it's not a breather in that sense. It's maybe I'm exhausting the analogy here, but it's taking a full time off and going on your travels to find yourself. It's more than a breather. but that comes from the Manchester United hierarchy and the fans themselves. That's my point as a journalist on the outside. I felt that happened and has been happening for a long time. The only problem comes with, when you sit Roy Keane and Gary Neville and people in studios and go, this is Manchester United. And like, get over it, lads. It's been like that for ages. And, I'm not saying that to you pointedly as a Manchester United fan, but there are some fans also that for this, whether it's a breather or whether it's, 3 months in a yoga retreat finding yourself, I've definitely ruined the analogy now, but whichever one it is, in order for those things to be actually conducive and productive to something good at the end of it, the people involved, the club and the fans, have to allow it to happen. So, you're a fan who's pushing for an overhaul of the squad. The club actually have to get behind that. And then all the other fans have to as well. So, yes, maybe you're right. It is about an acceptance that this has got to happen. But yeah, as I say, it's more than a breather for me.
Just finally on this, because I don't want to make it all about Manchester United. What I would say is, I think even though you think it's been a few seasons, a lot of people were in denial. Because after finishing second under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer last season, there were plenty of big names, plenty of fans saying Manchester United are going to challenge for a title this season. And so it clearly hasn't been, a shared sentiment for a very long period of time. But I don't think anyone can now claim that this is a team on the up anymore. We're going to move on because there were plenty of other interesting things that happened in the Champions League this week. In particular, Juventus, Ian, suffering a late blitz from Villarreal in Turin, losing 3-0 on the night, 4-1 on aggregate. Another Unai Emery masterclass, was it?
To an extent, yes. But just on Juventus, and Hugh, I don't know if you're looking for solace, but... United aren't the only fallen giant, and there's a fair parallel with Juventus, although Juventus's decline is probably a bit younger than Manchester United's at the moment. But it can happen, and clubs can look very confused about how they try and get out of it, and Juventus are right there at the moment. Having said that, there's quite a lot of indignation at Juventus about the way they were defeated, and it's not complaining about referees. It's complaining about Unai Emery masterclasses being a little bit too pragmatic. And they did take a bit of a battering in the first half. However, he made some inspired changes, and Villarreal kept their cool, which was that really is something I think you can credit to Emery, who is really the professor of the European knockout tie, as long as he's speaking the same language as most of his dressing room. I would add that as quite an important thing with Emery. But yeah, but a sensational scoreline. I mean, you go to Turin and win 3-0, and they really did keep their cool, which I thought was the striking aspect of it.
I saw some describe this as the worst European side Juventus have had. I'm sure you'll argue with that. There must have been worse than this, but where does it rank?
Juventus have a real neurosis about the European Cup, which goes back generations. That they are underrepresented with their titles. Even some of the titles they have got sort of little asterisks by them, Hazel and so on. It's in the whole sort of Juventus mythology, there's a thing about the European Cup. And when Antonio Conte was there at the beginning of the sort of the modern resurrection of Juventus, they weren't very good in Europe. That was a striking deficit of his time there. Man for man, I'm not sure if you could say this side that lost yesterday is the worst they've had in the Champions League. I mean, they have just spent a huge amount of money on a fantastic young centre forward, Vlahovic. Now, he's relatively young, he's new to the Champions League, but he would certainly not like to think he joined the worst ever Juventus European side. So So there's been some slightly hysterical reaction to a lot of aspects of this defeat.
Hysterical reaction, Ian. That sounds also like quite like Manchester United. And one other thing that perhaps is a parallel, and correct me if I'm wrong. You know, you mentioned Vlahovic there. He's a recent signing, but you know, looking at the team, Manuel Locatelli, who was one of the kind of stars for Italy at the Euros, he joined in the summer, and then before that, Matthijs de Ligt, widely tipped as one of the superstar footballers, came out of that Ajax team that everyone loved, of course. Is it a case that some of these signings just haven't come off, or that they haven't, you know, they've gone for players who aren't quite able to deliver on that Juventus level that you talked about there in terms of the mythology and the aura that comes with playing for Juventus? Or have they actually been a bit poor and haven't lived up to the hype?
I think that's a very good question. De Ligt is an interesting case. You know, one day he's the Phil Jones of Amsterdam. The next day, you know, he's the new Franz Beckenbauer. I'm afraid he had a Phil Jones night last night. But yes, I mean, you know, they have been aggressive, as you say, in the transfer market with young players over the last 4 years. And you can't say that their judgment is flawed, especially with those three that you mentioned. Young central defenders, there's always an element of gamble. And De Ligt was a teenager when they bought him for a huge amount of money. And on the one hand, you know, he has the great learning of Bonucci and Chiellini around him all the time. On the other hand, he's being measured by their standards and having to find a role for himself, you know, in the marriage that they've had for so long. So quite a challenging job. But I'd be interested in what you think. Where do we imagine Matthijs de Ligt will be in 5 years' time? Will he be the new Virgil van Dijk, or will he be, sorry to harp on about this, Phil Jones?
Well, I mean, I followed that Ajax team in great detail because at the time I was writing quite a lot of pieces about European football. And I mean, I would have said beyond van Dijk at that point, but I think that was partly due to how that Ajax team was viewed as well, because of course, my best mate, Donny van der Beek, was seen as a superstar midfielder of the future. And now, of course, he's facing relegation in the Premier League with Everton. I think with De Ligt, you would say that he still has the chance, as you know, some of the things you talked about there, those players that he's playing with and around and learning from and being in that pressured environment, I would say he'll probably go more the Van Dijk way than the Jones way. But just to then give me some context as well, is it, you know, you talked about Chiellini there, and I saw that he was on the bench last night. Is transition part of the situation for Juventus, where, you know, for so many years, part of that Juventus aura was that they had the legendary Italian experienced players all the way through the spine of the team. And that was true in the 90s when I was watching football and, you know, following the European Cup. I remember there was a great interview clip, which I think is still doing the rounds, of, I think, a young Gary Neville, Manchester United, just when they'd got through the group stages. And before the interview starts, he asks the guy, "Have Juventus got through?" And then he says, "Yes." And he kind of rolls his eyes and puffs out his cheeks and says, "Oh my God, bloody hell, typical." You know, and that kind of carried on all the way through, didn't it? With Buffon, Chiellini. Are these guys on the way out and they've not found the replacements there isn't the replacements within the Italian league?
I think you're right that the transition is clearly essential. And possibly a bit like Manchester United in terms of strategy, transition was interrupted, and it was interrupted with the very, very significant devotion of resources to Cristiano Ronaldo. Now, again, this is not, we can't blame everything on Ronaldo, and I think we have to be careful of that. But Ronaldo took up so much of the budget and clearly was a project focused on the Champions League and, you know, a project that sort of, you know, put heavy brackets in the transition process. And of course they found the wrong managers to oversee this transition. Allegri is back there this season, having left 2 years ago, and his predecessors only lasted a season each. One of them was Maurizio Sarri, who Juventus didn't work for Juventus, but at least he won the title. And then the second one was Andrea Pirlo, who was out of his depth. You know, he may become a good coach, but it looks a very naive appointment now. So, yeah, a transition that has gone off in in all sorts of odd directions, but is still very necessary.
While we're on managers, Ian, I guess there's Max Allegri's future. I mean, if it's under any threat, but we should mention Erik ten Hag's Ajax going out as well, beaten 1-0 at home, 3-2 on aggregate by Benfica, who make a first quarterfinal appearance since 2016. Will Max Allegri still be in the job? And on ten Hag, is there room for, let's call them, another club to approach?
This Champions League round might have been subtitled Manchester United Managerial Shortlist Cock-Up, won't it? Pochettino, Ten Hag, Allegri, who should, you know, should logically always be in the Manchester United conversation. Look, you know, in various states of bewilderment or indignation, but certainly with their, you know, their short-term reputations damaged by what's happened in the last week or so. Will Allegri survive? I would say, now, assuming they finish fourth, and that's, you know, that is not, or in the top four rather, and that's, you know, that's not guaranteed. I think he will have satisfied most of the requirement as, you know, as it stood at the beginning of this year, because they made a very poor start to the season. He has made them far stronger domestically. That's not a big deal, really, because it, you know, it's not a brilliant Serie A at the moment. But, you know, they also have to ask themselves, do we want to change our head coach for the third summer in succession? I think there's still a degree of trust with Allegri.
We shall see. We shall see what happens next with these managers and clubs. But I thought the Champions League was absolutely brilliant this week and will continue to be. The draw, of course, will be made tomorrow afternoon. So we'll have a little bit of reaction to that on Monday. There is more still to come. We'll talk about the Premier League games this week. We'll look ahead to the FA Cup weekend very quickly at the end of the podcast as well. Well, it seems like it's going to be a regular feature on the programme for the moment. Let's talk Chelsea next. The sale of the club still looms, but when and who it will be and for how much, we don't really have those answers as yet. It doesn't feel like the club or the UK government knows either, and that means the club is certainly in limbo. Chelsea definitely failed to read the room this week over the sanctions handed down to their owner, Roman Abramovich, when on Wednesday they had to withdraw a request for Saturday's FA Cup tie at Middlesbrough to be played behind closed doors. The Premier League side, of course, not allowed to sell tickets for the game and initially made the request for matters of sporting integrity, which didn't go down very well with the football public and didn't go down very well with the Middlesbrough chairman, Steve Gibson, either. He said Chelsea and sporting integrity do not belong in the same sentence. Of course, Roman Abramovich denies any and all allegations of links to the Kremlin. Let's speak now to Martin Ziegler, who has brilliantly been following this story for the Times. Martin, where are we now? Are we any further down the road as to knowing what will happen with Chelsea?
Well, I think we know that the sort of various interested parties are sort of gearing up, and by the end of the week, there should be the Rain Group, which is conducting the sale, will have a full list of everybody, and then we'll be able to make a proposal to the government about obtaining a license to actually sell the club.
Who are those interested parties? Is there a front runner?
It's quite difficult to say. I mean, there's a lot of people this week have come out and said that they're interested. I mean, the Ricketts Group, a family who own the Chicago Cubs baseball team. I mean, they're apparently linking up with Ken Griffin, one of the richest people in the USA, worth £20 billion. They've declared their interest formally. We've got Sir Martin Broughton, the former chairman of British Airways, who's linked up with Lord Sebastian Coe, fronting another bid. We don't know who their backers are. I mean, it's fair to say neither Coe nor Broughton have the money to do it themselves. Absolutely not. And then there's the property developer from London, the Candy Brothers. And then there's a sort of Swiss-American group. But it's the LA Dodgers co-owner Todd Burley and the Swiss billionaire Hans-Jörg Wyss, along with the British property developer Jonathan Goldstein. So some people say they're the favourites, but I think it's almost too difficult to say.
There are bigger questions, and there were bigger questions this week around ownership in English football. There was a digital culture, media and sports session held this week. A few people appeared. Mark Bullingham from the FA, Helen McNamara, the policy chief from the Premier League, was there, as well as the sports minister, Nigel Huddleston. And I listened to all of it, I have to say, and there weren't many clear answers for the Chelsea fans. For those of you that didn't sit through all 4.5 hours, nothing was particularly clear other than it doesn't seem like football as a whole knows its ear from its elbow when it comes to the owners and directors test, when it comes to having a real understanding of who should be involved in English football. It became very apparent that over the last 20 years, it has been about encouraging as much money as possible to build as great and as glitzy a Premier League as we possibly could here. Now this week, Martin, there are questions of Abu Dhabi and in particular Saudi Arabia, as we saw some reports that Saudi Arabian media group wanted to buy Chelsea as well. And fans are asking this, how do we square the involvement of Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia in English football when we see the pressure now and the scrutiny being put on Chelsea in Russia?
Yeah, it's not easy, is it? I mean, you know, I don't think states should be involved in buying football clubs personally, but it's easy to get around that because you can pretend that you can be a state and you can pretend that you're not involved and that you can just use an individual who's sort of connected to the ruling family or whatever and they can buy the club. It's easy to get around rules. I mean, I think the owners and directors test is, it's in theory, it's a good thing, but it's really, really difficult to impose and decide who's suitable and who isn't. I mean, it's easy enough to say if you've got a sort of 5-year prison sentence, you shouldn't be allowed in. But there's lots of unsuitable people who want to buy football clubs, and it's very, very difficult to draw up criteria just for the sake of, I don't like their cut or their cloth, or I don't like the fact that they're involved. They're close to a sort of unappetizing Middle East government. It's not easy, is it? I mean, look at all these people lining up to buy Chelsea. How do you make the decision about who's okay, who's good for English football, and who isn't?
I've got to say, the Premier League's answers at the sports session with the DCMS were laughable at times, in particular when it came to the takeover of Newcastle United. Basically, the Premier League said, if there's any evidence that the Saudi state meddles with Newcastle United, then we will act. They haven't set the parameters of what that meddling would be, and I cannot see, and they couldn't tell us how they would actually get any evidence of this happening. So all of those assurances that we were told at the time, well, they don't really know how on earth they could disprove or prove, if you like, that the Saudis were, and this is the Saudi state, the public investment fund, but above that, the Saudi state itself was running the club. I mean, it's just laughable that they've told all of us that they've had assurances when they haven't even set the parameters of what breaking those assurances would be. And once again, big questions, Tom.
I kind of echo a lot of what Martin said. It's very difficult because, speaking as a fan of a team in the Football League further down the pyramid, lots of fans look at this situation and kind of echo Martin's point, is how do you judge what is a good football ownership? And when you think back to the Super League and all the conversations we had around that with we need to rebuild the game, we need to change the image of the game. You know, we're talking about Chelsea and then Newcastle and ownership issues right at the very top. But you could argue that actually there needs to be, as they're trying to, as they have tried to, some kind of root and branch, look at ownership throughout the football pyramid. And there would be lots of fans up and down the football pyramid who would be saying, yes, you should tackle big issues like Saudi Arabia and Russia, but also there are more, questions closer to home as well. So it's not a simple one. And I sound a little bit like a politician at a DCMS hearing here because I'm dancing around the subject, because there isn't any definitive answer, if you like. One thing I wanted to just briefly come back to on Chelsea, and I don't know whether Martin has any kind of insight on this and whether you feel the same, Pew, but this might be in my role as the cynical editor. Again, what's in it for these guys to buy Chelsea? I know obviously there's been lots of discussions around the property side of things in terms of regeneration of Stamford Bridge and the area around it. But part of me wonders whether, is this a case, Martin, of a lot of people using I'm interested in Chelsea in order to raise their own profile and then maybe not actually see it through with a fully fledged bid, in the same way that, say, sometimes we criticise clubs and their owners for saying, oh yeah, we were in for 6 or 7 superstar players in Europe, but you know, it just didn't quite come off. You know, it's a bit of a PR game to say, yeah, I'm in the hat, I would be interested in Chelsea. Is that the case at all?
I think that's definitely the case. Yeah. Just go back very quickly to what you were saying, Tom. I actually completely agree with you about the EFL, because there are some really good steps you can take the owners and directors test, which would have stopped, for example, the former owner of Bury and the former owner of Bolton Wanderers, who took those clubs into administration. That would have stopped them buying it, taking over their clubs. The former Bolton owner had been banned as a company director for 8 years. But because was regarded as spent, he was then allowed to do it. So it's very easy to change the rules to say, you know, if you've been banned as a company director, then you can never buy a football club. I think that's perfectly fine. So there are very easy things you can do. There are less. I mean, the Saudi Arabia, the thing about it's not state owned. I mean, that's a joke. Obviously, you know, the Saudi public investment fund is the Saudi state, and anyone who thinks that they are not controlled by the Saudi state, I believe, in my opinion, I think is a joke.
There is one other question that I wanted to ask you guys, and I've been slated for it on social media. I was accused of having a Chelsea witch hunt, and I want you to decide for me if I'm wrong on this. And I'm being genuinely honest here. So UEFA, I want to call them hypocrites, basically, because at the start, when the invasion of Ukraine happened, they immediately banned Russian teams from UEFA competitions, and they banned FIFA banned Russia itself from playing international matches. And I know that there's an argument around, well, who wants to travel to Russia and who wants to play against these teams, and would the players be in danger or the fans be in danger if they were traveling? You know, in my opinion, I think the teams could have traveled, they could have played these games in neutral venues, and they could have played them behind closed doors. But Spartak Moscow's place in the Europa League obviously went with that decision. The EU this week has sanctioned Roman Abramovich as well. And I wondered whether at that time, Roman Abramovich, still the owner of Chelsea, he had not yet even been sanctioned by the UK government when Spartak Moscow were kicked out of the Europa League, why UEFA didn't kick Chelsea out of the Champions League? And is that a question that they should answer? Should Chelsea have been allowed to continue? And I know people will say, why punish the fans? I don't think the fans of Spartak Moscow are responsible for what's going on, but they have certainly been punished for it by virtue of their location and their nationality. The fact that the Chelsea owner has been strongly linked with events in the Kremlin for a long time and has directly been sanctioned as a 100% owner of Chelsea, and again, we can quibble that with what's been happening over the past week, shouldn't Chelsea have been affected in UEFA's club sanctions? Surely they should have been, Tom.
Oh, why have you thrown to me, Hugh? That's not fair. I was waiting for Martin to go and then I could just copy whatever he says. He's a 3-time award winner. Part of this situation feels to me like, and this applies with the ownership as well, one of these situations where it slightly runs away from football organisations and they're just hoping that it kind of gets sorted and you can kind of carry on. You know, hopefully Chelsea gets sold very quickly and we can all carry on. That feels like a lot of the situations, you know, it's a completely different scenario, but say taking the football's approach to COVID, it was very much carry on playing, let's keep the games going, and let's be honest, let's keep the money flowing in for the TV rights and all that kind of stuff. So I feel like football organisations at the very highest level have come up against very difficult worldwide situations that go way beyond football. And often the approach has been maybe not keep calm and carry on, but panic quietly behind the scenes, but carry on. And I feel slightly like that is what's happening here, because I agree with you, Hugh. They could have taken a very tough stance and said, you're out, for all the reasons you outlined. But then they opened themselves up to further scenarios down the line. Maybe at what point do you kick teams out for various different things that are related to things way beyond football? And so it feels like to me, it's not necessarily a great excuse, but it feels like that's the approach that UEFA, FIFA, all these kind of massive, massive organisations in world football have taken, that you hide behind the, we must keep the game going. We must keep the integrity, you know, use that word again, integrity of the game. We must keep the game going for the sake of all the other teams in it and for the fans, when actually it's about the keep the money rolling in and don't let the politics and the big world scenarios be too much a part of the game.
Yeah, I don't think it is comparable to Spartak Moscow, actually, Hugh.
I knew you'd be the voice of reason.
No, I'm not the voice. I don't think it's the same. If you followed your argument, you'd also have to kick them out of the Premier League and the FA Cup. And effectively, what you'd have to do is you'd have to put Chelsea out of business. I'm not sure that is the best way of hurting Russia, which is what this is all about. Do you think they should be kicked out of the Premier League?
No, I don't think they should be kicked out of the Premier League because it's a domestic competition which hasn't set a stance in that regard. UEFA have taken a stance. They've kicked Russian teams out. I imagine that is to put pressure on the events happening in Russia. But in fact, they would have a bigger chance of putting pressure on Russia by affecting Chelsea than Spartak Moscow, in my opinion, because of the alleged, which Roman Abramovich denies, links to the Kremlin. I imagine that's why the EU and the UK have sanctioned Roman Abramovich.
Yeah, I mean, the English FA have said that they're not going to play any Russian teams, so that they're not going to allow Russia to come to play in the European Women's Championship this summer that they're hosting. So they are taking steps against Russian teams. So I think you have to go the whole hog and say Chelsea can't play at all, rather than just they can't play in Europe. That's what I think.
That's me told.
I don't think that is right, actually, because I think that's not hurting Russia. Abramovich has already said he's not going to, you know, he's going to basically, I think it was an effort to try and avoid sanctions, that he's not going to get the money out of it himself. So I think it would be a sort of fairly meaningless step.
Finally, with me being told then, I'll shuttle off back under my rock. When do you think Chelsea fans will have clarification on their future? Is there a date in your mind?
Well, I think it will be, say, like tomorrow, we get a sort of preferred bidder, maybe Friday, end of the week. And then maybe a couple of weeks after that for, you know, the sort of Premier League to authorise it all, make sure it's in no way controlled by a national state.
Well, they haven't got a great track record on that, but okay, we'll see if they can do it this time. Martin Ziegler, thank you for being with me. I'm sure we're going to speak very soon on Chelsea. Appreciate it. But I should say before we end this segment, Roman Abramovich denies any allegations of wrongdoing. Of course, anyone at Chelsea, the same. Appreciate it, Martin. Take care.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
There was a great game in the Premier League last night. Liverpool beating Arsenal 2-0 away from home, closing the gap at the top of the table to just 1 point, and Manchester City there, of course. Mohamed Salah was on the bench. It did take a while for Liverpool to get going, but a very good win in the end. And a good performance from Arsenal, even though they were beaten. Mikel Arteta feeling his side could have got a lot more without the two errors that led to the goals in the match. I did want to start with Arsenal on this, Tom. They lack the sort of 10-15% they needed to get over the line, a little bit like their defeat to Manchester City earlier on in the season when they were definitely the better team. But it's clear they have made a big step forward this season.
Yeah, definitely. I think these games, and similarly with wins away at Watford 3-2, as you say, it shows that building, it shows that progression, because a year, 18 months ago under Arteta, they draw that game with Watford. They play against Liverpool and Manchester City and they get turned over 5-0. this season, they're winning those games against the lower and mid-table sides, and they're giving Liverpool and Manchester City a good game. And as you say, it's fine margins. Against Manchester City, it was stupidity that cost them with the decisions and the reaction to it. And yesterday, as you say, it was mistakes from Ramsdale and Saka, two players who've been outstanding this season. That is where Manchester City and Liverpool are at, isn't it? That's where they're at the very, very top of elite football in Europe, if you like. And if you make mistakes like that, like not covering your near post because maybe you're thinking, oh God, he's going to go across me, and like Saka's clearance, which Robertson intercepts. So yeah, I think you're right to paint it like that from an Arsenal point of view, because they remain in contention for a fourth place, which would be, as I've said before, a fantastic achievement for them this season. And even in defeat, there's still hope for them going forward.
Are Liverpool going to be stopped, Ian? What do you think now? Are they just on the you know, it's inevitable, this sense that they're going to keep winning and winning and they will usurp Manchester City?
There was a lovely quote, wasn't there, from Jurgen Klopp last night about momentum. You know, he really is becoming more and more of a poet in English, isn't he? Momentum is a fragile flower. Listen, I didn't hear this, but I saw it quoted. So, they have a fabulous rhythm to them, don't they? But I think there will be a slip up before the end of the season. And I would still say that Manchester City are going to win the title by a narrow margin.
You think the same, Tom?
No, I'm going Liverpool, as I did on the show with Alison a few weeks ago, Hugh, when we got into quite a heated debate, didn't we? And I think you backed City to the hilt.
Yes, I'm still backing City at this point in time.
I've made lots and lots of bad predictions on this podcast, but I would like to just say that even back in that run when the gap was far bigger, I did say I didn't think it was over. Just because, and it's not particularly astute analysis, it's just purely on watching a hell of a lot of football as I do in my job, Manchester City just don't look as good, as clinical, as effective as they did last season. But interestingly, you know, it is as much about that momentum of Liverpool. I was looking at some of the stats from last season, you know, and lots of the stats show that Manchester City are roughly about the same in terms of performance, goals, shots on target, shot conversion rate, all those kind of things. Most of them actually slightly better this season than they were last season. But it's actually the case that Liverpool, you know, after that slightly disastrous season, are back to where they were 2 years ago and really absolutely flying now. And as you say, with Mo Salah on the bench, doesn't matter. Jota steps up, Firmino steps up. And I think the massive thing for them under Jurgen Klopp and this squad, which is largely unchanged from the team that won the title a few years ago, is that they're no longer the Liverpool waiting for a Premier League title. They won it 2 years ago. Let's just go and do it again. It takes that pressure off. And so they can be this relentless force chasing Manchester City all the time. But equally, I agree with Ian in that I think there will be further slip-ups from both teams. You know, a lot of our debate, Hugh, when with Alison on that show where Alison and I said Liverpool and you said Manchester City, revolved around the idea that neither of them would drop many points and it would ultimately come down to that big game in April. I actually think there might be a few more Crystal Palace scenarios, potentially for both clubs, but certainly for Manchester City.
Well, Manchester City's has already happened, if you like. We'll talk about their game in a second. But I did want to come to two of the biggest cliches in football. Although I should mention, I should mention that I think Liverpool's real strength at the moment is the quality of Alisson and Virgil van Dijk, Joel Matip playing really well and giving them platform in every single match. Because even when teams play well against Liverpool, they don't seem to convert their good periods into goals. But I did want to talk about one of their other defenders, because like I say, two big cliches, one Manchester City, this one Liverpool. Jurgen Klopp talking about Trent Alexander-Arnold, who was getting destroyed by Gabriel Martinelli. There's no other way to describe it. Many people call Trent the best right back in the world. He's sort of a 7 out of 10 defensively, though. He's about a 10 out of 10 in the final third. I think he's got 16, 17 assists or something like that this season. Unbelievable for a right back. But after the game, Jurgen Klopp said, "If anybody says to me Trent cannot defend, they should come to me. I'll knock them down. Honestly, I cannot hear that anymore. I don't know what the boy has to do." But like I say, I think he's about 7 out of 10, Tom. But he's better than Kyle Walker and Reece James defensively. Defensively?
Probably not far off Reece James, to be honest. I think Reece James is actually quite a similar player in style and in the guise of a modern right back. You know, a lot of this debate probably comes around you know, there's maybe some dissertation style piece to be written on the evolution of football and fullbacks and what the definitions mean and how we think of them. Because you say a right back is a defender and therefore defenders have to defend. But in modern football, a right back is far more than that. And actually, probably more important is his attacking ability. And so, as you say, Trent Alexander-Arnold in some games being an 11 out of 10 as an attacking force for Liverpool is more important than him being a 7 out of 10 as a defender. That's just the case. I mean, Kyle Walker is probably a better defender largely because of his absolutely lightning pace, which allows him to recover in all sorts of positions. But, you know, let's think about João Cancelo, a right back who is not the same as Trent Alexander-Arnold, but is in the sense of that thing I just talked about, the modern game. I don't necessarily think he's a great defender, but I wonder whether with Trent, it's almost maybe because he's English, maybe because he burst onto the scene for such a long time. You know, you have your period of raving about pet players and then you kind of go, right, well, let's pick out what he can't do. But actually, I would say that maybe, I don't know, does anyone think Cancelo, for example, is a better defender than Trent Alexander-Arnold? And he's a player who we constantly rave about and say, what a fantastic modern footballer he is. Look at him straying into midfield. Look at him picking up the ball in pockets of space. Look at that pass he played. Oh, wow. Look at that goal he scored. You know, all these things apply to Trent Alexander-Arnold as well. But we often focus on those moments when a quick winger gets in behind him. That happens to João Cancelo all the time, doesn't it?
No, I see what you're saying. And you're absolutely right. Maybe I was just being harsh on the guy. I do think Klopp was a bit too strong because after what Ivan Perisic and Gabriel Martinelli has done to his player, I think that was a bit much. He needs to work on that area of his game. Hopefully that message gets across, not just from Jurgen Klopp. I think the fans need to get that message across as well. He would be, if he was a 9 out of 10 defensively every week, he wouldn't just be the best right back in the world. He would probably be one of the best players in the world, full stop. And I mean, top 5, top 10 players in the world, full stop.
But, you know, we're talking about European football. We've got Ian on the show. You know, thinking about players like Cafu, Roberto Carlos, and then also players like Paolo Maldini. You know, Paolo Maldini didn't score goals and create goals in the same way that those other players did. And those other players didn't defend like Paolo Maldini. The idea of you're almost talking in a robotic sense about building the complete footballer, which would probably be, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold with the ability to defend like Virgil van Dijk. You know, you'd probably have the ultimate footballer there, wouldn't you? I mean, Ian, am I wrong in kind of placing it in the context of that European, more European sense and the idea of a modern footballer?
I think, I mean, you're absolutely right. And you know, the idea that a young, ambitious fullback has about his game now is completely different from a couple of generations ago. And I think it goes beyond simply, you know, mastering an entire flank, Roberto Carlos wise. It is looking at central midfield, isn't it? It is not just thinking primarily go on the outside. It's really seeing so much more of the pitch as your territory. Now that's a big ask for a fullback to do that and do the containment stuff, which they get judged by all the time. As soon as you say, Martinelli or Vinicius gets behind Trent, then he's criticised. But I wonder. I mean, Klopp has spoken about this in the past, and I think Trent Alexander-Arnold has. You know, whether he might stop being thought of as a fullback at some stage in his career, and you look at a player like Joshua Kimmich, who was a right back when he started. A bit further back, Philipp Lahm. You know, they became something else entirely, and that was, you know, that was how they evolved as footballers.
Mm. It's an interesting debate. Like I say, I think Trent is absolutely brilliant. Must work on that part of his game, I think. Too easy for players to get past him. I know Klopp basically made out that Gabriel Martinelli was prime Kylian Mbappe last night, but I mean, come on, do me a favour. Ivan Perisic is 10 years older. I mean, these players, I believe Trent Alexander-Arnold should probably get the better of him. And although people will say, you know, it's rarely played out that he has made errors leading to goals. Like I say, I think Alisson and Virgil van Dijk play a big part in that. Erling Haaland's expected to join Manchester City in the summer after being offered a salary package that would make him the Premier League's highest paid player. That's according to his club Borussia Dortmund. His contract runs out in the Bundesliga in 2024, but he does have that release clause allowing him to leave for a fee of around £63 million this summer. It seems the financial incentives that City's Abu Dhabi owners are able to offer have been the decisive factor. Talk of wages in excess of £500,000 per week. Matthias Sammer, who's a consultant at Dortmund, said his wife had to help him off the floor when he saw those numbers. But it doesn't mean Liverpool might have to take their opportunity this season, because my word, this could make it a wrap for Manchester City. I watched their game against Palace on Monday night, and they are missing a presence in the penalty area. They are missing some movement. It's great when the false nines, I think there's two of them when Manchester City play with them at the moment, click. But when they don't, I mean, it just looks like they've got 10 players at times. Nothing, you know, I think they had over 50 touches in the opposition penalty area. Again, they had good chances. But I think you have a Haaland in the penalty area and you batter Crystal Palace on Monday night if you're Manchester City. So this could be one of the biggest signings, Ian, in Premier League history.
Yes, and, you know, and they should be very, very excited if they get them, if they get him. I mean, the process of extracting Haaland has been quite a dance, hasn't it? He's obviously, you know, he's got expert advice. His dad knows the game very well and is a very sharp-minded guy. But there was, you know, there was a long time when the messaging was that he wanted to go to Spain. So I'm always cautious at, you know, what might have the whiff of an auctioning tool, but you cannot see him not being successful in the Premier League or wherever he goes, and as you say, you cannot. The idea of him at Manchester City does really, really look like, you know, the last perfect piece of the jigsaw.
I'm hesitant to say this, Hugh, because this might be the greatest clip of all time for our producer John to keep and save and keep up his sleeve to embarrass one of us further down the line. I'm just not sure it's as simple as buy Erling Haaland, suddenly get massively better. Manchester City are a phenomenal team under Pep Guardiola. They have been for the last two seasons, playing largely without a striker. When you've been playing like that, and players like Raheem Sterling, Bernardo Silva, Riyad Mahrez, and to a lesser extent Kevin De Bruyne have been performing in these kind of rotating, flexible roles, when you then bring in a player like Haaland, who is a phenomenal force of nature, if you like, but, you know, operates in and around the box, as they say, and requires crosses into the box, requires delivery, requires balls in behind. You know, because you don't want to sign Erling Haaland and then having him switching places with Phil Foden, who I've also forgot to mention there, which kind of proves my point. You want him in the box for those moments when he then scores a hat-trick against Crystal Palace, as you were suggesting, Hugh, and they win 3-0 and they romp to the title. If and when they sign the next striker, whether they go back for Harry Kane, whether they get Erling Haaland, it will be another evolution for Pep Guardiola to undertake at Manchester City, I think. I don't think it is as simple with that team, with all those players, to just take Haaland, who is still a young player himself, who is still, for all his talent, learning his game, and put him in the team and go, jobs are good. I really don't. I don't know whether that's because I'm too complimentary of the current City side or whether it's because I have my reservations about...
So what you're saying is he will not immediately improve Manchester City.
I don't think it's as simple as that, no, because I think for all... He is an incredible asset, an incredible talent, an incredible player. But in adding him to the team, A, you take out one of those players who have played together for a long time now. You know, that kind of rotating cast of, let's say, those four players, Bernardo Silva, Raheem Sterling, Phil Foden, Riyad Mahrez. They're able to interchange both not on and off the pitch and then in positional spaces because they know each other and they work so well together. One of the things we've talked about with Chelsea, for example, is that they've got all these forward players, but they've never really settled on who plays where and what roles they are and don't seem to have developed relationships. Those City players do have that relationships. And I don't know. Maybe I'm being far too negative and I should just be blindly excited about a talent like Erling Haaland coming to the Premier League. But I just don't think it's as simple as taking him and adding it to that, because I also think you then take something away from the current City, and that means you then need to not completely start again. It needs a heavy, heavy tweak, I would say. And that doesn't happen instantly.
Yeah, I think you might be doing Erling Haaland down just a little bit.
I'm sure I'm doing him down more than a little bit, yeah. Ian. But that's just my thoughts. But go on, please tell me why I'm so wrong.
I mean, I think you're right about the potential to disrupt a very, very smooth operation. I think that's quite right. I think possibly it would be dangerous to caricature, which I know you weren't doing as a target man. I think I think Erling Haaland would certainly think that he's got the feet and he's got the capacity for growth to do the things that Raheem Sterling and Riyad Mahrez can do if he puts his mind to it, you know, as well as unleash these rockets from 35 yards out and put himself on the end of crosses and so on. You know, I put it this way, to put it simply, I can see him being a Pep Guardiola footballer.
I think he's going to fit. I think one of the big things is, if he does move, it looks like City are getting it done early. He's going to have the full pre-season out there with his teammates and Pep Guardiola to adapt. And he does need to adapt. I think he's going to have to work harder and he's going to have to work at his movement, because as we saw against Crystal Palace, a lot of Manchester City's games are compressed into the opposition half and he might not have as much space to run into, for example. But I definitely think he's talented enough, more than talented enough, to make it work.
Can I just ask a quick question, Ian, about something that just popped into my head, and maybe the comparison isn't accurate, but Zlatan Ibrahimovic at Barcelona under Pep Guardiola, because that was a transfer that, you know, perhaps not the same, but you had this supreme talent who could, as you've just highlighted with Haaland, that perhaps I didn't, can do it all, can score from long range, can score headers, can hold the ball up, can interlink play, will run the channels, can get in behind, is a global megastar. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the kind of Ibrahimovic Barcelona Pep project didn't really work. Was that more a personality thing in the end and a clash? Was it because, you know, you already had Messi and Ibrahimovic didn't fit? Or was that a case of, you know, perhaps some of the things I'm talking about, not fearing with Haaland, but suggesting could be the case in terms of things not quite fitting and needing to make changes that didn't work?
Yeah, I think you've summed most of it up. There was certainly a personality issue developed, and these are two quite stubborn people. Ibrahimovic's explanation, or the bit that doesn't reflect solely on Ibrahimovic's explanation of it, was that this was precisely the time that Guardiola made a significant transition in his thinking about that Barca team, and that Messi should be much more central and much more of a focus, and Ibrahimovic was prejudiced by this. That's the tactical Zlatan view. He scored quite a lot of goals in its one season there, but yeah, it was, you know, it was a misfit situation relatively. So yeah, I mean, you're right that with such organized, such patterned teams as Guardiola develops in most places, there's an element of risk.
Would be a huge signing for the Premier League, one to look forward to for all of us. Another great player coming to the competition. And look, £500,000 a week, I think we'll be having those conversations about state ownership, etc., if that signing does get over the line. Still more to come on the Game Podcast, but remember, if you're enjoying it, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed. Right, before we go on this week's episode of the game, it has been a sensational season in the FA Cup. It has been a season of shocks, and we are hoping for more this weekend. The quarterfinals are upon us, and it is really just for us to pick out our shocks and quickly say what we think might happen this weekend. Let's start on Saturday. Only one game on Saturday. Middlesbrough hosting Chelsea. There will be fans at this game, thankfully. Sporting integrity, unfortunately, not being upheld, but there you go. Who do we think will win this one, Tom?
I mean, I think the phrase, we're all Borough, aren't we, comes to mind with this one. Not just for some of those ludicrous statements that came out of Chelsea, but because they were the story of the last round. I watched their game when they knocked Tottenham out, and they were fantastic. Chris Wilder's a manager that gets a lot of praise. I think he's in that period at Middlesbrough where, you know, we talked about momentum with other clubs on this podcast. It feels like they have a bit of momentum behind them, and they'll have the whole fan, they'll have the whole place behind them, not just because they're playing Chelsea, not just because they're on a good run, but because of some of those things that happened before the game. Will it mean that they will win? Chelsea have got so much quality, and as Ian said in their game in the Champions League, are operating with a bit of a kind of ruthless efficiency at the moment. So I will say 2-1 Chelsea, but yeah, it'll be a really good game, and Middlesbrough will certainly do themselves credit, I would say.
This could be the shock. They've already got rid of Manchester United. They've already got rid of Spurs. They're at home to Chelsea. Ian, what do you think?
It's a wonderful run, and you know that would, you know, that would be a great trio. But I think Chelsea, they've got real depth as well. There'll be some impatient players fielded, I imagine, by Thomas Tuchel, and I think they will show the distinction in class. It won't be the most popular national result, but I'm afraid I think that's probably what will happen.
Crystal Palace against Everton on Sunday. Everton not really needing a cup match at this point in time. Crystal Palace, though, Patrick Vieira, 5 wins as a player, great legacy in this, in competition, if you like. Is he going to take his team into the semi-finals, Tom?
I think for both of these teams, I look at this match and think about some of the narratives that come with both clubs. Palace fans, I know a few Palace fans, some of them work in the Times office very close to me, so I often hear their reactions after matches. And they're at this moment now where it's the hope that kills you, is the ultimate expression. They'll be going into this game thinking, we've just drawn with Manchester City, we're at home again, we can beat Everton. And so in that respect, it would be the most Crystal Palace thing to lose this game. Equally, it would be the most Everton thing for them to win this game. As you say, they don't need this. They desperately need to focus on the Premier League. They don't need another cup match. They don't need a semi-final. In that sense, I'm going to go 2-0 Everton, because it would be the most appropriate result for both of these clubs. And in some respects, maybe that's a shock. Does that count as a shock, Everton winning away at Palace?
Yeah, I think it does. Ian, do you agree?
No, but not for any particularly learned reason. The better club at the moment, I think, will win this football match. It's as simple as that. But you can also imagine that there's a need for Everton to have some release. You know, it's really gloomy, isn't it? So, an impressive Everton performance. I mean, that would be something to grasp at, wouldn't it? But Palace to go through.
I'm just about to head up to Goodison Park to see their game against Newcastle. So I think that might affect things as well if it goes very badly. It might be big changes for Everton in this one. Difficult to see them going through. The one that I've got most question marks over, Southampton against Manchester City, goes one of two ways for me. Southampton have been pretty dire in their last two games. Whether they get a kick up the backside and suddenly decide in front of their home fans, and they've been excellent at home this season, that they're going to go all out. And Manchester City, who we imagine will make a raft of changes, 7 or 8, whether their players are a little bit rusty, or whether those fringe players at Manchester City decide that they're going to turn it on and win 5-0. I mean, it's one of those. It should be very, very intriguing. And a very tough one to call, actually, for me. What do you think, Tom?
You summed it up perfectly, Hugh. I think that outlines the two most likely scenarios. I'm going to, in the need for having dismissed Middlesbrough, and in the need for wanting to pick a shock, I'm going to go 2-1 Southampton. Because I think your first scenario could happen, in the sense that, again, it doesn't sound particularly astute analysis in the way that I summed up Everton and Palace, but equally it would be very Southampton, very Ralph Hasenhüttl, to be pretty good for a couple of games, then be pretty shocking for a couple of games, and then turn up at home and put in a brilliant performance back by the home crowd and beat a Manchester City who are perhaps slightly more distracted than they would like to be. 2-1 Southampton.
I'm going to apply a very, very sophisticated psychological tool to analyse this one. City have drawn 2 games 0-0, haven't they, in the last, 9 days? It's not going to happen again. They're going to win this.
The final one of the weekend, Nottingham Forest against Liverpool. Again, Forest, a couple of shocks for them. They've knocked out Leicester. They knocked out Arsenal before that. They now host Liverpool. I've been at the City Ground for the previous two games that I mentioned, and it's been absolutely brilliant. I think Liverpool's going to be a step too far, but maybe Steve Cooper will show us once again why he's such a highly regarded coach. Tom?
Yeah, I think you're right. Forest deserve great credit for really energising the cup this season. And under Steve Cooper, similarly to Middlesbrough and Chris Wilder, they made a managerial change that has really worked for them. I fear that Liverpool's momentum at the moment is such that Forest could easily play quite well and lose 3-4 nil, and there'd be no hard feelings on any count, because Forest then go back to chasing a playoff spot. But yeah, I can see a comfortable Liverpool win.
Totally with Tom on that. The difference between the middle of the Premier League and the top of the Championship, I think, is, you know, it's not that great. But the difference between the top of the Premier League and anything in the Championship is huge, isn't it?
Okay, well, we're going to react to all of those FA Cup matches on Monday. Ian, thank you for being with me. Tom as well. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of our award-winning journalism. And if you sign up today, you'll get yourself 1 month free. As I always tell you, make sure you check it out. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you on Monday.